Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Nursing Home and Hospital Patient Safety Initiative Pressure Ulcer Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Pauline Kinney.
Good morning. Welcome to today's presentation. We appreciate your joining us for this morning's conference call presentation, which is part of a series of educational offerings addressing pressure ulcer prevention and treatment in nursing homes and hospitals. Today's topic area will focus on current nursing home and hospital standards of care. Copies of today's PowerPoint presentation were forwarded via email. These slides that will be referenced during today's presentation. In addition, a program evaluation form was forwarded to you. Please be sure to fill out the form and fax it back to IPRO at the fax number indicated on the form. As a reminder, this conference call session is being taped and will be posted to the IPRO Jenny site to make it available for future review. The address for the site was on the handouts. However, feel free to contact us if you need the address once again, and we will send you the link. As mentioned, all of your lines are currently muted, but following the presentation, we will be opening the lines for your questions and further discussion. We're very pleased today to have Drs. Jeffrey Levine and Mona Barastani as our guest speakers. Dr. Levine's professional focus is improving the quality of care delivered to elderly persons. He is president and founder of Senior Health Consulting, Inc., which provides education and medical, legal, and risk management advice to insurance companies, attorneys, and facilities regarding care of the aged. His consulting clients have included the United States Department of Justice, the New York State Department of Health, CMS, and various law enforcement offices. Dr. Levine received his fellowship training in geriatrics at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Manhattan. He is board certified in internal medicine, is a certified medical director, certified wound care specialist, and holds a certificate of added qualifications in geriatrics. He is also past president of the New York Metropolitan Area Geriatric Society. Dr. Levine has been studying and lecturing about pressure ulcers for the past 25 years. He is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine at the New York Medical College and has a hospital-based wound care practice at the St. Vincent's Hospital in Manhattan. He has published dozens of articles on this topic and was co-author of the recently released Clinical Practice Guideline on Pressure Ulcers published by the American Medical Directors Association. He has also designated and delivered a training program for pressure ulcers that was delivered to hundreds of nurses employed by nonprofit hospitals and nursing homes throughout the New York City area. Dr. Barastani is an associate professor at East Tennessee State University in the Center for Nursing Research, where she is currently serving as principal investigator on clinical wound healing studies while holding a wound healing clinical education and research appointment at the James H. Quillen Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Johnson City, Tennessee. Dr. Barastani serves on the board of the Association for the Advancement of Wound Care and the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. Dr. Barastani currently serves on the NPUAP International Pressure Ulcer Guidelines Committee as the Debridement Task Force Chair in collaboration with the European Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel and served on recent Pressure Ulcer Staging Update Task Force. Dr. Barastani was also the Vice President and Chair of the NPUAP Neonatal and Pediatric Pressure Ulcer Task Force. Dr. Barastani has served as a clinical consultant to industry, long-term care, and home care facilities, as well as performing medical-legal consulting. Dr. Bahestani has presented over 730 national and international lectures on wound healing topics. She has published multiple book chapters and peer-reviewed articles on a variety of wound care topics. So join us today in welcoming our speakers, beginning with Dr. Levine.
Well, hello, everybody, and good morning. And thank you very much, Pauline, for introducing me, and thank you for inviting me to this educational conference. Today, we're going to talk about nursing home regulations that are related to pressure sores. The objectives of today's talk are to understand how the regulatory environment shapes wound care in the nursing home, understand how state surveyors look at wound care and how it connects to other aspects of care, and also to pinpoint barriers to effective compliance. I should tell you in my background that I started working in nursing homes in the late 1980s before OBRA was implemented, and I had the opportunity to watch the nursing home industry evolve before, during, and after the implementation of the regulations. So this is a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and I'd be more than happy to answer questions about the regulations at the end of today's discussion. We have a slide set, and I just want to start off with some definitions of what is OBRA. OBRA 87 equals the Nursing Home Reform Amendments, which according to the Code of Federal Regulations is Chapter 42, Section 483. OBRA is an abbreviation for a long name. It stands for Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. I don't expect you to know that. But OBRA is basically the law that governs nursing homes. The second definition I'd like to go over are what are the interpretive guidelines. The interpretive guidelines are the standards that are set by CMS to guide surveyors into interpreting whether or not facilities are rising to the task of meeting the standards set in the Nursing Home Reform Amendments. So in other words, the interpretive guidelines are written in a simple format. They're to guide surveyors step by step when they walk into a facility to answer the questions, did this facility fulfill the minimum obligations that are required by the law? The next definition I'd like to go over is the F-tag. The F-tag is the number that references the regulation. So every regulation has several F-tags, and those F-tags reference that regulation. If you get cited, you get cited under an F-tag. Investigative protocol. An investigative protocol is the step-by-step instructions that the surveyor knows to investigate a potential departure from the standard that can lead to a citation. And it's basically a cookbook, who to talk to, what kind of documents to look at, what you need to know to determine whether or not the facility departed from the standard. And finally, on this list of definitions is severity guidance. When the surveyor wants to cite you, they use the scope and severity grid, which we'll get to in a moment, to give you a letter which designates the scope and severity of the departure. And that letter would dictate the severity of the, not only the severity and the scope of the departure and the citation, but would also mandate specific penalties. Let's go to the next slide for deficiency categorization. If you are cited for a departure, the key elements of severity determination are the presence of potential harm or negative outcomes, the degree of harm related to noncompliance, and the immediacy of correction that's required. And the next slide presents your scope and severity grid. You can see it goes from left to right is the scope. The first column is isolated, and then there's pattern, and then there's widespread. And then from bottom to top is the severity. The bottom row across is no actual harm. The next line is no actual harm with potential for more than minimal harm. And the next row is actual harm that is not immediate jeopardy. And when you get to the top row across, you have immediate jeopardy to resident health or safety, and that's the levels J K, and L. So with that background, I'd like to go through the F-tag for pressure ulcers that was recently revised. Now, unfortunately, I just need to point out that there was a typographic error in my introductory slide and also elsewhere in the F-tag for pressure sores. It's listed as F-tag 309. That F-tag should be 314. So please write that down, that the F-tag for pressure sores is 314. The next couple of minutes, I'm going to go through the F-tag for pressure sores. I'd just like to point out that the F-tag for pressure sores, as it's been rewritten and re-released, it's the interpretive guidelines for the interpretation of the surveyors, for the surveyors, that's been rewritten. And it's a very comprehensive guide for care and treatment of pressure sores, and I would strongly advise to get a hold of this F-tag interpretive guidelines, because it really is very informative and actually takes the form of a clinical practice guideline. I have this in PDF form. If you'd like my email address is jlevinemd@shcny.com. You can email me, and I'll email you back with the PDF of this F-tag. So let's go ahead and talk about what's in the F-tag. Based on the comprehensive assessment of a resident, the facility must ensure that a resident who enters the facility without pressure sores does not develop pressure sores unless the individual's clinical condition demonstrates that they were avoidable. And we're going to get into the issues of avoidability in a moment. The highlights of revised F-tag 314 include the following. They include definitions of wound care terminology, detailed documentation requirements, detailed assessment requirements, detailed staging and risk factor discussion, emphasis on nutrition and hydration, discussion of resident choice and advanced directives. There's a detailed prevention section that goes through terminology that's related to prevention and terminology related to prevention devices and pressure redistribution devices. And finally, there's a definition of avoidable and unavoidable. What I like about this revised F-tag is it pulls in the interdisciplinary team. For example, when you talk about discussion of resident choice and advanced directives, this is going to involve the social worker. This tells you that you got to have your social worker involved with the team when caring for pressure sores. It also talks about definition of avoidable and unavoidable, and to me, this means you got to bring in the doctor, because the physician is going to help you not only define medical conditions, but define medical conditions that are related to potential unavoidability of that pressure sore. Further on in my discussion today, we're going to talk about involvement of the medical director and how the medical director could be involved with wound care. Let's move on to avoidable definition. Avoidable means that the resident, and this wording, by the way, is quoted directly from F-tag 314. Avoidable means that the resident developed a pressure ulcer and the facility did not do one or more of the following. Evaluate the resident's clinical condition and pressure ulcer risk factors. Define and implement interventions that are consistent with resident needs, goals, and standards of practice. Monitor and evaluate the impact of the interventions, or revise the interventions as appropriate. The next slide will give you the unavoidable definition. Unavoidable means that the resident developed a pressure sore even though the facility had evaluated the resident's clinical condition and risk factors, defined and implemented interventions that are consistent with resident needs, goals, and standards of practice, monitored and evaluated the impact of the interventions, and revise the approaches as appropriate. So let's take a look at how this could be applied on a day-to-day practical basis in your facility. When a surveyor takes a look at your record to determine whether the ulcer was avoidable or unavoidable, they're going to take a careful look at that chart to see whether you did all these things, whether you assessed the residents' risk factors, whether you implemented appropriate interventions that were consistent with the resident needs, goals, and standards. And from this investigation, they're going to make a determination whether it was avoidable or unavoidable. So what we're saying here is that you need to assess, and you need to document your findings, and you need to document proactively what you did to prevent that skin ulcer. I'm going to move on to one of the additional things that was added in revised FTAG 314, and this is the new National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel standard for what is a suspected deep tissue injury. Deep tissue injury includes signs which suggest that the injury has occurred deeply within the tissue, which may later evolve into a stage 3 or a stage 4 pressure sore. Deep tissue injury can evolve into a healing and no ulcer at all. So when you suspect deep tissue injury, it could evolve into just about any stage. The MDS does not code for deep tissue injury, and coding of wounds on the MDS should be accompanied by detailed narrative notes describing the wounds. Another important component of revised FTAG 314 is the link of pressure ulcers and end-of-life care. And I'm going to read directly from the quote from the FTAG. If the facility has implemented individualized approaches for end-of-life care in accordance with the resident's wishes and has implemented appropriate efforts to try to stabilize the resident's condition and to provide care to prevent or treat the pressure sore, then the development, continuation, or progression of a pressure ulcer may be consistent with regulatory requirements. What this says is that in the end of life, if you are providing proper end of life care and a patient gets a pressure sore, that you might not be cited for that, provided you did the right thing for end of life care. I'd like to move on to the investigative protocol process. The surveyor will come in and determine if the pressure sore was avoidable or unavoidable. The surveyor will also determine the adequacy of the interventions and the efforts to prevent and treat pressure sores. The surveyor will also, in their procedures, will observe whether the care plan was implemented. The surveyor can interview the staff, resident, family, physician, anybody they want in the facility for issues related to pain, refusals, or pressure relief. They can review the record for the appropriateness of assessments and interventions, including care plan revisions. And that's basically my introduction to the revised FTAG related to pressure sores. I wanted to discuss a couple of other newly revised FTAGs that relate to other issues but indirectly impact on your pressure sore care. And the most important of these is the role of the medical director. And this is designated as revised FTAG 501. And this directly impacts upon the activities of your medical director. And what I'd like to do is introduce this FTAG and highlight the way the medical director's activities interface with wound care. Prior to OBRA 87, there was no requirement for a medical director. And basically, OBRA 87 introduced mandatory medical directorship, and then revised FTAG 501, released in 2005, put teeth into the regulations by providing the surveyor with a roadmap to explore the medical director's role. The medical director is responsible for implementation of medical care policies and the coordination of medical care in the facility. FTAG 501 lays out specific requirements for regulatory compliance for the medical director, provides investigative protocols that we talked about, what they are, for surveyors to look at the medical director's role, and it ties medical direction into specific quality-related outcomes such as pressure sores. According to the FTAG, the medical director is required to coordinate medical care, provide clinical guidance and oversight regarding the implementation of resident care policies, collaborate with facility leadership, staff, and other practitioners and consultants, and help the facility to identify, evaluate, and address and resolve medical and clinical concerns and issues that affect resident care, medical care, and quality of life. When the surveyor comes into your facility, their job is to determine whether the facility has a licensed physician as a medical director. Then they determine whether the medical director, in collaboration with the facility, coordinates medical care and implementation of resident care policies, as we discussed. The surveyor interviews the medical director, can interview the medical director or other leadership roles. They review the policies and procedures. They determine how the facility obtained the medical director's input in reviewing, evaluating, and coordinating medical care. And then they determine how the facility and medical director exchange the information on quality of care. And I'd just like to go to this next slide to highlight how your medical director should and could be involved with wound care in your facility. The medical director can round with the wound care nurse. The medical director can review policies related to wounds and review the wound care formulary. As we know, there are hundreds of different wound care products, and the medical director can help you to narrow down which is best for your facility. The medical director should be educating the physicians regarding proper wound assessment, proper staging, proper use of the products. The medical director should also be involved with reviewing wound statistics in QA meetings. And finally, the medical director should be involved with any prevention devices that are introduced to the facility, and perhaps be involved with cost studies with regarding pressure sore treatments and pressure sore prevention. I don't think we'll have time for the last FTAG, but I want to call your attention to the fact that there is a new FTAG for nutrition. And this is available. It should be on the web if you take a look for it. But basically, I just want to sum up that the nutrition FTAG, and I'm going to skip three slides down, that the nutrition FTAG includes a detailed definition of terms, a detailed definition of avoidable versus unavoidable weight loss, and a detailed definition of nutritional assessment with emphasis on accurate weights and diagnostics. Detailed discussion of factors contributing to altered nutritional intake and absorption, and a discussion of resident choice, tube feeding, and end-of-life considerations. So we're seeing here a pattern that I think is very, very constructive of including resident choice and end-of-life considerations in our care of our residents with regard to nutrition and how nutrition is related to wound care. And I need to point out that wound care is a potential tag for additional investigation. This is my last slide. And if noncompliance with nutritional regulations has been identified, the survey team may have determined that concerns may also be present with related process or structural requirements. What this means is that if they find a concern with nutrition, it can open up investigations into assessment, care planning, hydration, medical director, and pressure sores. So in my view, the push toward the revision of the FTAGs, and I'm talking about the FTAG for pressure sores, medical direction, and nutrition, ties everything together in a team approach, in a comprehensive approach, in a reasonable approach to taking good care of our residents. And I think that's it for my time, and I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Baharastani.
Good morning, everybody. And that was an excellent presentation by Dr. Levine looking at nursing home regulations related to pressure ulcers. I'd like to thank you all for joining us this morning, and I'd like to thank Pauline Kenny for inviting me to be a participant. Right now we're going to look at hospital-acquired pressure ulcers, examining the new CMS payment ruling. The objectives of my session will be to review with you the CMS present on admission, or POA, and hospital-acquired pressure ulcer payment ruling. We're also going to look at cultural change requirements for achieving improved patient outcomes and proper reimbursement under this new inpatient prospective payment system in the hospital setting. If you look at the slide that shows you a bar graph, we're looking at acute care and pressure ulcer prevalence trends from 1999 through 2008. And what you'll see there is we do not have a statistically significant drop in neither our prevalence rates nor our facility-acquired pressure ulcer prevalence rates in acute care. When we look at the next slide, the 2008 prevalence by unit type, specifically in the areas of critical care, you see that the highest bar being that of the medical ICU environment with a prevalence rate of 25% and a facility-acquired prevalence rate of over 12%. Similarly, you see in the surgical ICUs and other ICU settings, we're still way above benchmarks for pressure ulcer rates. Pressure ulcers in fiscal year 2007 among Medicare patients was reported by CMS through their database to be affecting over 250,000 patients. When listed as a secondary diagnosis, the average cost per case for a pressure ulcer was over $43,000 per hospital stay. As part of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, CMS identified 8 preventable adverse events in August of 2007. It really caught their attention when they saw certain diagnoses with a very high rate as well as high cost. CMS has changed. As of 2008, it was initially identified in 2007, but regulations changed in 2008 that they would no longer serve as active purchasers, or they would no longer serve as passive buyers of health care, but rather active purchasers of health care. Their goal with the new inpatient prospective payment system was really to reward stricter adherence to evidence-based practice guidelines in acute care, to incentivize quality care delivery, and to more fairly pay hospitals for the level of care that they provided. So CMS identified a number of non-payment conditions. This is listed in your slide as CMS MS-DRG non-payment. MS-DRG stands for Medical Severity Diagnostic Related Groupings. Pressure ulcers Stage 3 and Stage 4 were identified, as well as falls and trauma, retained objects following surgery, air embolism, blood incompatibility, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, vascular catheter-associated infections, and surgical site infections, specifically mediastinus status post CABG procedures. These 8 hospital-acquired conditions were identified as being no-pay events. The financial implications in just looking at fiscal year 2007 of only these 8 hospital-acquired conditions through CMS databases they found was costing them over $22 billion in, again, one fiscal year. Well, initially it was that CMS wasn't going to pay facilities additional dollars if a patient developed a pressure ulcer in hospital. So initially it was just CMS for those patients, those Medicare recipients. Very quickly, though, other private payers looked at this. Blue Cross and Blue Shield, who are insurers of over 100 million people, are also not paying when these hospital-acquired conditions occur. Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Health Partners. It, again, initially started with those being Medicare recipients. This is translated very rapidly in the state of Ohio to also include even pediatric patients, neonates developing pressure ulcers in the hospital. The facilities will no longer receive payment for the care of those pressure ulcers that were hospital-acquired. Newly added hospital-acquired conditions to that 2008 no-payment ruling are DVTs and PEs, status post knee replacement and total hip replacements, surgical site infections, status post bariatric surgery, manifestations of poor glycemic control, surgical site infections following certain orthopedic procedures. These were also added to the 2008 no payment ruling. For 2009, the areas being looked at are ventilator-associated pneumonias, Staph aureus septicemia, and also conditions that are requiring further analysis include MRSA, Clostridium difficile-associated diseases, and wrong surgeries. If we look at the financial impact, again, only in our Medicare recipients, you can see in this next slide, stage 3 and stage 4 pressure ulcers, again, over a quarter of a million cases in fiscal year 2007, an average cost of hospital stay over $43,000, and the total Medicare cost at $11.1 billion. What CMS looked at was stage 3 and stage 4 pressure ulcers that have been identified as present on admission will result in an increase in payment under MS-DRG. So if there's documentation that a patient is admitted to a hospital setting with a stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer, then there will be an increase in payment to that acute care facility. Stage 1 and stage 2 on admission will not result in an increase in payment. Unstageable nor deep tissue injuries will result in an increase in payment. There is a caveat that we will look at this. Present on admission is defined as present at the time that the order for an inpatient admission occurs. So it's not clot-based as was initially thought would be the case from CMS's initial presentation of this ruling. So it's, again, when documentation of admission occurs, not clot-based. This is an important change. Conditions that develop during an outpatient encounter, including the emergency department, observation or outpatient surgery, are considered present on admission. Suspected deep tissue injuries and unstageable pressure ulcers are not specifically covered under the present on admission ruling, but there is a CDC provision to allow documentation of pressure ulcers in evolution. So let's say you admit someone to your facility, and on admission, they have a suspected deep tissue injury. During that hospital course, this suspected deep tissue injury evolves to unroof a full thickness stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer. You would then receive a bump up in your payment. If, again, during that hospital stay, it is then unroofed a stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer. So this would be a clause of the ulcer was in evolution, it was on admission, a unstageable or a deep tissue injury that, again, you can document evolution through that hospital stay. What about if a patient is admitted with a pressure ulcer at one stage and it progresses to a higher stage, then you're going to want to assign the code for the highest stage reported at that site. So even if you had someone who was admitted with a stage 2 pressure ulcer present on admission, you did everything appropriate for the care of this patient as far as pressure redistribution, nutritional indices, maximizing their medical condition, and that ulcer evolves during the hospital stay to unroof a stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer, then you would document the highest stage for that pressure ulcer during the stay, and CMS would consider a bump up in payment. When we say that the pressure ulcer must be documented on admission, who must document this? Well, it needs to be the provider. CMS defines provider as a physician or any qualified healthcare practitioner who is legally accountable for establishing the patient's diagnosis. So this could also include your physician's assistant and your nurse practitioners. My recommendation, though, is ensure that you have a physician documentation in that hospital medical record of the presence of this pressure ulcer on admission. In addition, you can have it in addition to other licensed independent practitioners, but the best recommendation is to also have the physician and preferably the attending, if at all possible. Dr. Levine gave us an excellent presentation of the difference under the F314 tag for long-term care of avoidable and unavoidable. But how does this relate then to our acute care arena? Well, unfortunately, even if a pressure ulcer was deemed unavoidable, that we had performed the pressure ulcer assessment on admission, we had addressed pressure redistribution, we had addressed their nutritional needs, maximization of the overall medical stay, friction, shear, moisture management. Even if we have done all of these and the ulcer was unavoidable, currently there is no appeal process under the CMS ruling. Even unavoidable pressure ulcers, if someone develops them in the hospital will still not receive any additional payment. Maybe this will be revisited in the future, but at this point in time, I emphasize there is no appeal process in the acute care setting. This is unlike long-term care. What impact will this CMS present on admission have on long-term care and home care? Well, at this point in time, these settings will not be directly impacted. Also, rehab settings will not be directly impacted by this ruling. This is specific to acute care hospitals. So what are the financial implications? Well, in patients with few medical problems, this impact could be quite substantial. For example, if you have a patient with an admitting diagnosis of an intracranial hemorrhage and a secondary diagnosis of present on admission is documented that they have a stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer. So they have a primary diagnosis of intracranial hemorrhage, but a secondary diagnosis of being having a present on admission stage 3 or stage 4. The average payment for this particular patient would be $8,030. If the stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer is hospital acquired, though, then the payment is going to be $5,347, resulting in a loss of $2,682. Multiply this multifold for many patients where similar situations will occur. So what can we do? How do we build a safer culture? Organizational support is paramount in acute care, in long-term care. There must be administrative support for a pressure ulcer prevention program and for educational programs. There needs to be adequate staffing. There must be ongoing learning. Education in the area of adequate pressure ulcer staging. Education on the, if you're in long-term care, education towards the F314 tag, which as Dr. Levine described, is an excellent actually guidance document. In acute care, ongoing learning about the CMS present on admission ruling, education as it pertains to pressure redistribution, nutritional maximization, overall medical maximization of our patients, and looking at decreasing pressure, pressure to sites, frictional forces, shear-related forces, and working as an interdisciplinary team. This education has to go across the board to nursing staff, to our nutritionists, our social workers, our nursing attendants, our medical staff, our physical therapists. It has to be across the board and to our administrators. We need to have a safe work design and avoidance of second victims, that we're not looking at blaming each other, oh, well, this patient didn't have an ulcer on my tour. You must have been doing an inadequate job on your tour. We need to look at the organization as a whole and ensuring that we have standardization. We're all looking at the patient from the time they enter our doors at prevention, being proactive. So there needs to be overall culture changes within our hospital settings. We have much to learn from long-term care. Long-term care has been showing consistently drops in their facility-acquired prevalence or incidence rates of pressure ulcers. We could learn a lot from them in our acute care settings. Again, emphasizing the importance of interdisciplinary communication and ensuring that in your documentation, in your medical records, that you're describing the interdisciplinary communication that has occurred. That we're following evidence-based practice guidelines and that our policies and procedures reflect this. That the care that we deliver reflects this. That our documentation reflects this. And that we're performing comprehensive assessments on all of our patients on admission. Do not take lightly to say skin is intact. Ensure that there's a full exam over the occipital region, pulling back the hair, and ensuring that there's not a pressure ulcer. Removing devices where at all feasible and looking under these devices to ensure that there's not an underlying pressure ulcer. Taking down TED stockings, taking down BiPAPs and CPAP masks and looking at the bridge of the nose. Look behind the backs of the ears in your patients that are getting supplementary oxygen. You want to ensure that in your facility you're performing prevalence and incidence studies or prevalence and facility-acquired prevalence studies and that you're sharing this information with your colleagues and that you're taking actions based on this data and that you're comparing to national benchmarks and benchmark against yourself and your own health systems. You want to ensure that your prevention programs are targeted to the patient population that you serve and triage pressure ulcer risk based on the high-risk patients that you are treating even before they arrive, if at all possible. For example, here in Tennessee where I work with a number of facilities that are level one trauma centers. We get notice that these patients are en route to the facility, but they're coming by helicopter. We already know the status of the patient before they arrive critically ill critical to our trauma center. So we can already be ensuring that we've got the appropriate pressure ulcer or the appropriate pressure redistribution surfaces in place, that we're addressing the needs of these patients before they ever arrive to our facility. This is the conclusion of my presentation, and we're going to open the lines now to your questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. If you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Denise Howell.
Okay, my question is for Dr. Levine. We were going into how a medical director can help in a long-term care facility with the wound care initiative. As a certified wound ostomy continence nurse, I found myself in the position of teaching the medical director what he needs to do about wound care. Now, how are you going to address this with facilities that don't have qualified, certified and credentialed wound care people?
Well, I wish there were more people like you around working in facilities. One of the deficits of medical training, unfortunately, has been that wound care is undertaught in medical schools and it's undertaught in residency programs. What I advocate is using organizations such as AMDA, the American Medical Directors Association, and this is something you can bring up to your medical director if you feel they need additional training. It's an undeniable fact that many medical directors are undertrained in this area, and I greatly appreciate your concern about this issue. But there are resources that medical directors can look toward to get their training. And AMDA is a wonderful organization. They have abundant educational materials that are targeted specifically toward medical directors and physicians in long-term care. And I would encourage looking toward AMDA, and let me see if I can find their website. I know they've got, for example, they've got their own clinical practice guidelines. And let's see, I'm trying to find their, I think if you just Google AMDA, American Medical Directors Association, you'll land on their page. But not only do they have clinical practice guidelines, they also have regional, they also have national and regional meetings that can update medical directors on standards of care.
And you raise a good, an excellent point here in that facilities that do have certified wound specialists, certified wound ostomy continence nurses, they can really be major drivers of these initiatives in not only long-term care, but also in acute care, working with the interdisciplinary staff, working hand-in-hand with our medical colleagues. Now, in the past and in the future, you know, this is going to be extremely critical for ensuring proper payment and also for driving the best quality of care that we can provide for not only long-term care patients, but also our hospitalized patients.
In my opinion, there's really no choice in the matter for doctors. They've got to become up to snuff with these issues. And if you have the opportunity to teach them, I hope you develop a good relationship with your medical director and encourage them to do their CMEs, continuing medical education, in this topic.
Well, yes, I have been doing that. But I also wanted to bring up another observation is that because of the discrepancy between pressure ulcer staging by NPUAP standards versus MDS, we have quite a difficulty dealing with not just the medical directors, but the other physicians who are not typically completely nursing home based. They also work in acute care facilities, and a lot of them have a hard time of making the distinction.
Once again, I'm going to point you to the FTAG, and this is something what we're looking at is culture change.
Exactly.
And what's gone on in the past is no longer acceptable now and will not be acceptable in the future. In the past, the doctors in the community were doing whatever they wanted regarding staging and treatment. And you just can't do that anymore. I mean, we're approaching a phase in American healthcare where the regulations, we have to follow them. And now it's with pay for performance, like Dr. Baharastani was talking, this is going to come sooner or later. This is going to come into nursing homes, and it's a question of our economic survival in our facilities. And I'd like to go over once again my slide that how the medical director can be involved with wound care. The medical director can be rounding with the wound care nurse, reviewing policies and procedures related to the wounds, reviewing the wound care formulary, educating the physicians regarding proper wound assessment. And the mechanism is there because every medical director is required to have medical staff meetings. So this should really go through your administration. Many facilities have medical directors that don't spend enough time in their facilities and don't spend enough quality time in their facilities, and this simply needs to change.
And in relationship to your point, which is another excellent point to have raised, was the inconsistency between the staging system that you currently must work with on the current MDS versus the revisions to the NPUAP staging system. Just be aware, though, if you can make it till October of this year, these two systems will be one and the same. The MDS will be changing and will acknowledge the updated pressure ulcer staging system. So come October, you will not have to be classifying suspected deep tissue injuries, you know, where you're looking at maroon or purple intact skin as stage ones. They will have their own category of suspected deep tissue injury. And in the same token, unstageable pressure ulcers will actually have a category versus you now having to stage them as stage four pressure ulcers if you're looking at an area with eschar. So I know that it's difficult. I work in acute care here now in Tennessee. I used to work with a lot of you in New York until I moved back to Tennessee.
I
now
remember.
Long for us.
Hello, everybody that I've left behind. Pleasure to be able to speak, even though it's through the phone. Uh-huh. But right now I work in both long-term care and the hospital setting, so it's been quite an eye-opening experience for me. And I start my presentations in long-term care. Look, you have to know two languages at this point. And how I teach them, and this might be helpful to you if you're not already doing this, is to have a chart for them that basically crosswalks them. Here's the MDS staging qualifiers and the NPUAP. So when documenting, and you will have physicians coming into long-term care who may be consultants coming in who are also practicing in acute care. So if they come in, what they could, well, your own staff that must document using MDS staging, they can put in their note, MDS, for example, stage 1, parentheses, actual presentation, suspected deep tissue injury, intact purple discoloration. So unfortunately, you have to have two languages in that medical record, and it would behoove, since you are the wound specialist and you have medical director buy-in, that there also be a note after these consultants come in to maybe clarify or to round with them so that there's clarity in these medical records so that it's not confusing, because right now it can be quite confusing.
Yes, that's built into our documentation.
When
I do my note, it always has the clinical stage versus the MDS stage.
Okay,
and
great.
The way I explain it to the physicians is that the MDS system is based on reimbursement. They want to maximize the reimbursement for the more significant injury.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clinical, it is financial, and this is what it's geared to. And that seems to give them a clearer understanding of why they have to do it that way.
Great.
So I've had success with that with a lot of our physicians.
Are you done with your question? Okay, our next question comes from Jane Ellen Barr. Jane Ellen, your line is open. Try unmuting your phone. Our next question comes from Harold Hellman.
Oh, hello. I'm Jacqueline Horsford, and nursing here with Dr. Susan Street McKinney. This is a long-term care facility. My concern is, now that the hospitals are more or less being penalized for pressure ulcer, there are times here in long-term, a patient can leave here and go to the acute care setting, comes back with a pressure ulcer. 2 weeks later, that patient may have to go back to the hospital with that pressure ulcer. Maybe the pressure ulcer is not healed. For them, they'll be documenting present on admission. There's no way then. How do we deal with situations like that? Is there a tracking method?
Can I answer that, and perhaps Dr. Baharastani can chime in?
Yes.
You need to pay close attention to your admission and discharge documentation. It's the best way to approach this problem. And this is something that's happening all over the country. Everybody's concerned about it. I think we need to protect ourselves by doing good admission assessments and good discharge assessments. And I'm talking about any time a patient moves from one place to another, any time a patient goes from inpatient to outpatient, and even in the hospital when the patient moves from one setting to the next, for example, ICU to the floor, et cetera.
Okay,
I'm having a fire alarm here, so that's what you're hearing.
Okay.
I will add to this, and initially when this ruling was discussed that, okay, a hospital, if they develop a stage 3 or a stage 4 pressure ulcer, they're not going to receive an additional payment. But if that patient then is discharged and readmitted, now they have a present on admission stage 3 or stage 4, which will equate to additional payment. So then there was concern, so will this then result in facilities potentially discharging the patient before they clinically are appropriate to be discharged, readmitted, to get that additional payment? The medical director that we had worked with at NPUAP through CMS said, beware anyone that considers doing this in acute care. There will be tracking. There will be unannounced audits of acute care facilities looking at your trends and patterns. They already know your typical pattern of discharge and readmission. If all of a sudden they're seeing these bump-ups in facilities that are rapidly readmitting, and then they go back and they're looking at the codes and they're seeing that you're readmitting these patients with pressure ulcers, there will obviously be penalization and fines. So this will be checked. You spoke also to another excellent point of what about these patients going back and forth and back and forth. Is anyone going to look at, so where did the ulcer actually originate? What's happening with these patients? There's a workforce demonstration project that actually started in January of last year now. It was actually looking at something called the CARE instrument. And what this instrument is looking at is electronified medical records that will follow our patients, our Medicare recipients, as they transfer between long-term care settings and acute care settings and other settings, and they come in through emergency rooms. So one day into the future, we will actually have electronified records that when Dr. Levine has a patient in long-term care and he sends a patient to one of your acute care facilities, you will actually be able to look at an electronified record of, so how did they manage this patient's pressure ulcer in his facility, and vice versa. As he receives a patient from acute care, he will be able to look at this electronified record. This, unfortunately, is something that has been long overdue, that there's not been enough communication between the different practice settings. And I think this will help us deliver better care and have better forms of communication among the different care settings. Also, it very well may equate into the future of more prolonged accountability, not snapshot accountability, because there is the potential that if this system is finessed enough and is sensitive enough, then there would be the potential to track back, however far back it requires, where did this ulcer start. You know, the problem with this clinically that I see is we all know that a pressure ulcer, especially these deep tissue injuries, may not manifest themselves at a macroscopic cutaneous presentation for days. So there could be an underlying ulcer that we don't see on admission. So then this opens the door to our future and future technologies of deeper scanning maybe being in our futures.
Fill out your evaluation.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Should I stay on board?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Virginia O'Connell.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. It's relative to how hospitals ought to reconcile the difference between the way the documentation comes to us from a patient from a nursing home that may have a pressure ulcer identified as a stage 4, but our staging here would probably have identified it as SCAR.
You want to handle that, Mona?
Sure, and then you also chime
okay.
in. If we were to receive, I'll put on an acute care hat now, and we receive a patient on admission with a, you are seeing an SCAR at this point in time. So what you're receiving is an SCAR. Remember, if we go back to the present on admission ruling, an SCAR is not going to result in an increase in payment for this pressure ulcer present on admission unless during that hospital stay that pressure ulcer is debrided, exposing a stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer. So basically, regardless of the fact that long-term care had to document stage 4 because of the MDS, what we are seeing on admission to acute care is an SCAR. We can't stage. So until that ulcer is debrided, we're not going to get an increase in payment. I would caution, though, of course, we must always let clinical appropriateness drive all of our actions, not payment. So here, too, this was brought up to the medical director from CMS when we met at NPUAP before this was ever released. If it is clinically not appropriate to debride an SCAR, let's say it's on the calcaneal region, a fixed eschar without clinical signs and symptoms of infection, where that eschar serves as its own biologic cover. Yes, we're not going to receive additional payment, but for clinical appropriateness, we very well may not debride that ulcer and not receive additional payment.
And I'd like to add, thank you, that was a great answer, Mona. Thank you very much. I'd like to add a comment to that, that when we document our ulcers, simply putting the stage is never enough. We need to describe, and I always encourage people to just write about it. Write a couple of sentences about it. What does it look like? If you have to write a full page, write a full page. But just simply the stage and the dimensions, to me, are not enough. They should be supplemented by a narrative answer, a narrative description of what that ulcer looked like.
That's an excellent point. And to add to that as well, especially let's look at the situation, for example, someone is admitted with a stage four. That just tells me, all right, the greatest anatomical depth, but the stage four could be a healing stage four with granulation tissue to skin level. So Dr. Levine's comment is an excellent one. You need to further describe what it is that you're seeing. You may see an eschar. Well, further describe the situation. It's on the calcaneal region. There's no clinical signs and symptoms of infection at this time, so it is left in, you know, it's going to be left in situ so that there's further explanation.
Our next question comes from Laura Fogelman.
Hi, thank you for your presentation so far. Has anyone out there developed some type of a universal transfer form that would go between patients returning to and from nursing homes?
That's actually what I described in this care tool. This is a workforce demonstration project that is being spearheaded by CMS. So that is actually being tested as we speak, looking at the usability of this particular tool as patients transfer from long-term care to acute care and rehab settings.
And there's one also being developed in New York State, but it's in the early stages right now, and it's only going to be a test, and it's being developed by the CCLC, the Continuing Care Leadership Coalition, along with some other affiliates, I think including IPRO as well.
Thank you.
I'm showing no further questions.
If there are no further questions, Bill, would you like to close for us?
Sure. Thank you. This is Bill Gardner, and I hope that you've found today's presentation by Dr. Levine and Dr. Barastani informative and in realizing that there are challenges to each of the environments that we are working with. Our next conference call will be on February 11th, and we'll actually pair nicely with this, and we'll be discussing effective communications across settings. So I hope that you'll be able to join us, and that's on your calendar. And just a reminder to complete the evaluation form and to fax it back to us. The number is on the bottom of the form. Pauline, do you have anything further to add?
I just want to thank Dr. Levine and Dr. Barastani for giving this wonderful presentation today. And we will be looking forward to having both of you continue this monthly clinical topic. And I think that's it for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.